into a place and say, hey, I'm here and I want to help and I want to get involved and I want to get to know you and I want to be able to work with you. So how do I go about doing that? Who do I need to talk to? Kristen was the right person when it comes to, you know, she just literally this week started a new job at her role at in Marion County was a juvenile prosecutor. She worked in the juvenile court. Her office was over there. She knew the judges. Working with juvenile data requires a lot of extra hoops through IRB as well as our state legislature. We had to get some legal things approved, and Kristen was able to do some of that stuff for me. So it was a very much quid pro quo relationship. I'm not saying that it's all take from my side. She really, or from her side. I mean, we couldn't. I think this is really a really good example of a partnership. So. It sounds, like I said, trivial and flippant, but you really have to get in those organizations. And I see a lot of folks on the call. It's great to see all you friends. I miss you all terribly. But I think a bunch of people on this call would say the same thing. You just gotta get in there and spend some time to get people to know you and to trust you so you can work with these data.
Yeah, I'd echo that. The way I think about it is, how do you go from a relationship where you're a complete stranger to where you're a colleague or have a professional relationship, and then ideally it progresses to a personal relationship where it's beyond the work, that you actually have colleagues that you share an interest with, that you can collaborate with, but it's not just transactional about the work. It's finding out about what their interests are. It's going to their kids' graduations and going to their parents' wake. So that to me is the enjoyable part of it, is if it's just transactional, if it's just, well, I need the data to finish a project or to get a publication. If professionally that's what your goal is to just, get data to generate publications, that's one approach. I don't see that as a long-term collaboration. That's very short-term. And as Natalie described, it's very one-sided. So how do you progress from being a stranger to a colleague to a friend? And in some ways it's like dating. Early on, you probably recognize, this just isn't going to work. That we don't look at things the same way. We don't communicate effectively. While it'd be great if we could develop something, it doesn't seem like it'll work. So to some degree, it's gotta be organic. The other thing that Natalie said that I want to kind of reiterate, it's you've got to be present and you've actually got to be genuinely interested. To go into an organization and say, hey, I'm here and I'd love to get your data, without knowing what they do or how they do it or the challenges that they face, can be very quickly dismissed if that's how it's viewed. So how do you generate those long-term relationships with mutual trust and recognizing what people may have going on that interferes with their ability to be responsive. And that's where the personal relationship, I think, is really helpful. I tell people it's all about relationships at first. You've got to have some kind of connection with people, even if it's just tangential. So I tell people, show up at the meetings, show up at the agency's public meetings, show up at the budget committee meetings in the jurisdiction for that agency, be familiar with what they're doing and what their issues are. And then at those meetings, try to introduce yourself or say, hey, there might be some areas where we have some common interests. So it's really, how do you develop a good relationship? And it really is one where you've got to have some degree of humility. I always joke that practitioners could care less if you published anything in criminology. They have no clue what the hell that is. And you probably don't know the significance that they were just appointed as a delegate to their regional professional association, right? So it's recognizing that we all play an important role and we can't get too caught up thinking our role is the only one that matters or it's the most important.
I think too, to kind of chime in from a practitioner point of view, before I met Natalie, my knowledge and understanding of data and research was very minimal. And so I think identify kind of the organizations you want to partner with and find the key people in those organizations. If Natalie would have started, so my former employer in Indianapolis is a very large entity. It has 500 staff members. if she would have started at our administrative level where we would eventually have to go to get permission, she wouldn't have known like the technical aspects of what to do and how to do it. So making sure you're identifying your key components. We have to make the project important to the people at the administrative level, but understanding that your relationships are probably most beneficial to you working with the people that are doing the work day in and day out that can help you interpret the things.
Yeah, and I would also say someone like Kristen is going to be able to come forward with questions that her bosses are going to want answered that I may not be thinking about, and frankly may not care about, right? But if we're having this mutual relationship and they want to know what the best color of shoes to wear is on a rainy day, then I need to incorporate that into my study somehow so I can speak to that. And it, is it, do I do it through a focus group? How can I do it to answer their question? And it may be, as David said, it may, they don't care if I publish that finding in criminology. It may not be that it's as scientific as it could be or as rigorous as it could be, but I need to be able to answer their questions that they have to make it important to them too. And same thing, so I can slip in the questions that they may not care about, but ones that from a theoretical perspective or job perspective or my research agenda are important to me. And so Kristen's the one that's saying, well, they're gonna wanna know. The judges, which are people way above who I would ever get a meeting with without their help, the judges wanna know if it's an attorney that's been assigned to them or a public defender. That's an important piece of information for them. So I need to make sure that I have that incorporated into my study somewhere. And so she's sort of that go-between to help me figure that out. And I use that dating analogy all the time, David. Some of these end in really nasty divorces, frankly. So you have to, it's hopefully getting out early if they're not gonna work out well, but agencies have been burned by their own data historically, which is why they're skeptical to begin with. So you have to earn trust like you would in a relationship and create a long-term. And you don't have to marry them and you don't have to be in love with them, but you have to be able to have a respectful relationship from both sides. So yeah, I love that.
And I think I'm glad you said it, because when I said to my wife, well, it's kind of like dating, she said, oh, I don't know if you should say that. Is this?
Oh, no, I use it all the time. I love it. Yeah.
But I think part of it is contemporary dating is different than maybe what we think of as historic. You know, it isn't all algorithms to figure out if it's going to be a good research coverage. Maybe that's some app that someone could develop. You know, it's like, you know, a matching algorithm that you pair a research with a practitioner, and empirically it improves the chances of it working. But like Natalie said, it's time in a seat, it's time in a car, it's time in meetings. That what you've got to just recognize is that if you go to a budget committee meeting for the prosecutor's office in the local jurisdiction, you've got to recognize why that's valuable to you. You should see it as a learning opportunity, but your potential collaborators see it as you being interested in their work and the things that matter to them. You know, to them, it doesn't matter about publishing research. It matters about getting resources to achieve their goals and implementing good effective programs. And I like Natalie's point about, you know, you got to find out what they want and convince them what you want. Sorry to tell everybody, but some of the research questions we have don't matter to practitioners. And if that's all they see is, oh, we're going to help them answer whether or not left-handed retail thieves are more likely to recidivate, that doesn't do a whole lot for us. We want to know what affects time to disposition, or does race really play a role in our case handling? So we've got to recognize that if we want to affect policy and practice, we have to answer the questions that policymakers and practitioners have. We should also convince them why what we're looking at may be important along those lines, but we got to recognize that their needs should be seen and not discounted.
And I think in that too is being open to being a little bit uncomfortable with topics that you don't know a lot about. Again, this project that Kristen and I are working with, it's a court-ordered program. I don't do courts. I'm a policy scholar. This is all happening after the police are done. And so, but it's in within my umbrella because they're gun-involved youth. So expanding my sort of comfort zone. I need to read a little bit more. I need to figure out a little bit more about how some of this stuff works. What are the questions that practitioners are asking? What are the theoretical questions that are being asked about court-ordered programs for juveniles? I don't know. And so digging into new literature, getting out of my comfort zone is also part of it. You know, again, building on these relationships and being able to say, well, I mean, I said to her, I was like, well, this isn't my general area. It's gun violence, which I can do, but let me see what I can figure out. And so far, so good. We've got tons of data, and now we just kind of have to figure out what to do with it. And I think thinking through as a researcher, Kristen kind of talked about this a little bit, where she said she didn't know really a whole lot about data and a whole lot about research. And so their main question is, does this program work? Does it prevent recidivism? And so the first thing I do is come back to them and say, well, how are you defining recidivism? And you can see, I gave a couple different examples, and you could see the light bulbs go off. Well, we want to define it lots of ways, which is perfectly fine to be able to do that, but to know that, to be able to incorporate it into analysis. So, you know, is it only a gun offense that makes it that the child is recidivated, or is it any offense, or is it a conviction? You know, all these different things where they don't really see that sort of global, you know, operationalization, the nerd stuff that goes behind it, and being able to let them choose. Because again, I've said to Kristen, I don't know how many times, you all need to decide what's important to you. Because I have in my mind what I think is important, but it has to be important to the people that are delivering the program.
Jump in for just a second. Dina, I think, had a question relevant to this line of thinking. Dina?
Yeah, it is related, and related to, you know, the idea that our research questions aren't always what's important to them. One of my biggest sort of fears and deterrents about working with practitioners is that I'm always afraid that they think I'm going to be telling them that they're doing their job wrong. Or telling them that their program doesn't work, or that, you know, they're racist, you know. And so I was wondering if you guys had any strategies for combating that. And I don't think that the system is racist, Kristen. Sorry. Maybe a little, but not a lot.
Go ahead, David. I'll follow you.
Yeah, I think part of it is you have to establish a relationship where you can trust them, or they can trust you. So, you know, I've never said anybody's racist. I've talked to them about how it seems as though race has an influence, what could be behind it. And the thing we got to recognize is we're here to learn as well. We can't view it as we're the ones there that know it. Like Natalie said, how do you guys want to define recidivism? You tell me what's important. You tell me about your processes that might be shedding light on these patterns I might be seeing that are helpful. The other thing is you just got to be clear what's your goal there. Your goal isn't to find out if what they're doing is right or wrong, or if they're racist or not. Your goal is to collaborate with them on improving the effectiveness and efficiency of the justice system, or the fairness of it. So you've got a common goal. You're approaching it through an empirical lens, and if you find out that the program isn't working as well as they thought, hopefully you've got a relationship where they understand how you reach that conclusion, and they recognize that you're doing it not because you have certain political views or that you have certain preconceived ideas. It's, well, here's the method I use to reach that conclusion. I'm here to teach you about the research process. You're here to teach me about your agency's decision-making, and we can come to an agreement. On it. Evaluations produce anxiety, and part of the anxiety is you're going to find out what we're doing isn't working, and you're going to leak it to the press, or you're going to leak it to someone who's running against me. And if you establish that that's not my purpose, that our goal is to help you improve the program, then hopefully some of that gets alleviated. But I've seen plenty of examples of where it didn't go that way because there wasn't the trust, and there was that ulterior motive of, well, I really want to show that focused deterrence doesn't work because I don't think the police should be, you know, targeting people that way. And they kind of ignore the science part and let their ideology take over.
Yeah. I echo what David has said. I think making sure you have a, have a buddy is the term that I've read in the past, and I steal that from Anthony Braga and Marianne Hinkle. I went from Project Safe Neighborhoods years ago, where you have a buddy in the institution that you can really trust to tell the truth to, and they can tell the truth to you. Because I think it goes both ways. There's sometimes where you need to hear something from the agency, that something that they don't like, or that's not going the way they think, or they don't think you're doing what you said you were going to do. And you have to have somebody that you can have this candid conversation with. And so when it comes to results, making sure that they get those results first, and ahead of time, making sure you're clear about what's going to happen with everything. I do want to get a publication out of this. That might take 3 years and nobody's ever going to read it because it's going to be in some other journal. Or I want to talk to the news about this or whatever. So being clear on what's going to happen, and then also giving them the opportunity to review the results first. So if you're missing something, if there's some piece that you aren't aware of in the process that's causing this outcome that may be considered negative, they can chime in and say, oh, well, that's because we label all these differently, you know, whatever the situation may be. So again, it goes back to the trust and the candidness you can have with the agency. And I have tremendous anxiety about this evaluation that we're doing. They've been doing this program for 20 years. And so if I'm the one that comes forward and says, yeah, it's not really working, I'm gonna feel bad about it. It's not gonna make it right, wrong, or ugly. I'm gonna feel bad about it, but I also think they brought me on because they wanna know. And so they don't want, you know, this wasn't a situation where they said, come in and tell me that this works, right? Which is what you hear as evaluators sometimes. They don't even wanna hear anything else. They want you to come in and tell everyone that the program is working the way it should be working. And when you dig into it, you figure out, oh my gosh, they're not even doing what they say they're doing and it's not working at all. That's a different scenario. So I feel better with this situation in that if it's not, and we don't know, we don't have any results, we've run any numbers yet, but if it's not producing the results that they think they are, I think they want to revamp. And so I think that's also what as an academic or someone that knows the research can bring to them and say, well, I've read these other things about focused deterrence, and this is how you might, if you're not doing it this way, the evidence shows that this is the way that might work better, and being able to present them with other options with that. But I have anxiety, you know, there's no doubt, at any time when you're bringing bad news, I think, and even good news, right? Because sometimes it's even like you're telling them it works because of this, this, and this, and they're like, no, that's not how it works. So all that work you did, again, it's a spurious effect. And so you thought you did all the stuff that's showing them something, and they're like, no, we already knew that. So there's that as well.
I think too, we're too focused on dichotomies of it worked or it didn't work. I always tell people, I've rarely seen a program that's a complete failure, where there's absolutely no redeeming quality to it. So it's how do you highlight the things that are beneficial? And it isn't necessarily an answer, did it work or didn't it? It's, is it working? And if it's not working as well as it could, what could be done to achieve it? That's the challenge in a political policy environment, because policymakers want to know definitive yes, no answers. It's not, there's no nuance. There's not, it works for this subset of people. Just tell me yes or no if it works. And so that's a challenge because it's not always that clear cut of a distinction.
I think from a practitioner point of view, I can only speak for myself and my experience working with Natalie on this program and a couple other initiatives. We wouldn't have asked or worked hard to get the records if we weren't truly interested in the outcome answer. So in terms of being nervous to kind of deliver the news that, like, yes, there is disproportionality in your program, and yes, you are treating people of color differently in this program, or yes, like this with policing needs to be done differently. You know, those are answers we need to know. In terms of the program that we're working on with Natalie right now, if there are institutional failures, we need to know, because we are dedicating time, effort, and a lot of resources into this program. And if that needs to be reevaluated, then we have to do that. Now, in terms of delivering bad news, this is just something that has kind of served me well in my almost 15 years of government experience is the compliment sandwich, which is, you know, not everything is a total failure. There's going to be amazing good things that come out of it, even if there is a glaringly terrible, awful thing that comes. So just make sure you say one good thing, then the bad thing, and then end on the good. And usually people will not throw you out of a meeting.
On a reviewer sandwich, when you're reviewing journal articles. Perfect, Kristen.
That is perfect. This really kind of leads into the next area, and then you guys are doing a great job hitting a bunch of, I gave them some potential guides I was going to hit, and you guys are doing a good job of conversational flow here, is a little bit about sharing of information, and not just kind of even the tenor of it. There's a couple of nuances there. There's, you know, just even getting the data, and, you know, I know I've run into this, is that I'm promised data, or they're like, yeah, we have this, and then it turns out, actually, no, we don't, for a number of reasons. Just their system doesn't really spit out what you think it does, or it's not clean, or just really difficult to work with, or missing data, I work in corrections, so we have all sorts of that. But at the same time, dissemination of that, then, kind of best practices, do you do it ongoing? In terms of as you kind of get some findings, you give them updates, do you wait until the end, formal kind of exchange? There's a lot of questions in there. So it's more kind of like, how do you share information and data?
I think I would put, and I'm speaking specifically to work that you're being paid for versus volunteer work or service or however you want to couch it. I think folks that are new to this should be really careful to specify in the contract who's providing the data and where it's coming from and what's contingent on the reception of the data as it's described. And I say this because I've been burned, and I know I can see folks on here that we've talked about it, where they promise you gang data and actually that doesn't exist. And so you have promised them an evaluation of a gang program, but no one can provide you any information about gang crimes. So now you're stuck. And so I've learned the hard way over the years to be very specific in my statement of work, to say the court data will come from the court. They'll provide it to the researcher. This is what it will include. And you don't have to be completely prescriptive, but if you need recidivism data to do a recidivism analysis, then they should be able to provide you with what you need. And it sounds very simple, but I have learned the hard way that you really need to put it in writing, because the other thing that you can be fearful of is they'll come back and smear your name, right? Because you didn't do the work you said you were going to do and all this other kind of stuff, which happens when if these relationships go up in flames or divorce or you break up or somebody's cheating on somebody, right? It's really important to have some of this stuff in writing where you can come back and say, no, you said you would provide these data to me. And then you can speak to that when other people ask you about it or other folks can defend you. And that's kind of a worst case scenario. But I think being really specific about what expectations are on both ends, not just from the researcher, you said you produced this product, okay, but you as a partner in this evaluation or whatever we're doing have to live up to what you said you were going to do too. And so they don't know. And some of the time is they don't know their data, right? And so sometimes it's good to kind of, can we do a test thing? Can you send me 100 cases? Can we, you know, try and, while you're waiting on IRB and all these other things, can we just make sure we've got what we know, or before you even fully engage? And so I'll stop there and let David speak. But I just think before you even get there, sort of specifying, especially if it's a paid relationship where it's not as damaging if it's not paid, right? Like if it doesn't come through, it doesn't happen. That's that. But if you're contracted or you're bringing in grant money and you're relying on this to produce it for the funder and it doesn't happen, then you've got other things you need to be able to explain.
I think it's good to think about it from kind of what Natalie described. In some ways, is kind of the legal side of it, like articulating in a contract or a data use agreement or even in an IRB application, this is exactly what will be obtained and how it will be handled. I'll kind of mention what I think are some of the informal things about it that are important. One is that you have to understand their data. You have to understand how it's collected, the proverbial, you have to see how the sausage gets made. And part of it, again, is you've got to learn about their processes. If you're getting data for a probation population or a prison population, recognize that the data don't magically create themselves in an SPSS file and end up in your on your hard drive, right? How is this collected? How much time does it take to do the assessments, to capture it? What's the context within which it's being collected? Fortunately, the work I've done with Illinois' prison system, I've gotten to see how the sausage gets made. I've gotten to be in the reception classification centers when they're doing the interviews with the inmates, capturing information, for example, about their gang affiliation or about their substance use disorder. And part of it shows that I'm committed to learning. I want to know how this information is collected, but it also then allows me to say, boy, the way you're collecting this stuff about gang information, you've got other inmates lined up in the hallway and they're not really going to be very honest. Or you get to talk to the people and say, well, we don't just base it on a tattoo. We've got other law enforcement intelligence that we use, and we go through their personal belongings to see if there's gang literature. So, okay, so it's not just he looks like he's got gang tattoos, therefore he is. You learn a little bit more about the data. But I think the other thing is to emphasize is what value do you add to the data? So if they're going to provide you with a lot of information, what do they get out of it? And a lot of times, as Natalie described, a lot of it's just you can analyze it for them. They've got all this information. They have no analytic capacity. So that's some of the value that you can add, is you can provide insight into what these data may tell or what they mean. A couple other examples, just things I've experienced or seen that I think are informative. One is I've worked with people that assemble data sets, they clean data sets, they label them, they recode them. That's essentially their job, is to clean data so that it can be used for research. They spend months or years doing that. And then they get a little frustrated when a researcher comes along and says, hey, how about give me your data set that you toiled over for years so that I can write an article, right? So part of it is you have to recognize that you have to give credit to the organizations and the people that you work with, because in many ways they've done the majority of the heavy lifting. We get nice data files that are all automated and we clean them a little bit more, and then we run some sophisticated analyses that they may not have the time or interest in doing, but we've got to recognize that it came from them and they need to get credit for it. And then the last thing I'll say about dissemination, I kind of to the earlier point about, you know, waiting till the end to tell them it's working or it's not working. Telling them along the way what you're finding and giving them kind of some insight. I evaluated a program with the Illinois Department of Corrections that was politically kind of a high profile program. They wanted me to do a presentation every week as to what we were finding. And then it was every month, and then it was every quarter. But part of the benefit of that is after about a year of doing that, I didn't have to explain anything to them about multivariate statistics or about the subpopulations that we're looking at. It was an interesting process where they became more data literate, and you were able to get into some good discussions. But some of it's the program, some of it's their desire, some of it's, you know, check in with us in 6 months and let us know how things are going, or check in with us at the end. But again, it depends on what the relationship is and how easy it is to do that. I think what we're learning with this environment of Zoom, we can check in a lot. I'm working on some projects where we've had, you know, Zoom presentations to different jurisdictions for a gun project we're doing, where we're able to check in every month. Here's what we're finding. Here's some interesting things, you know, to keep them informed. So,
and I think too, piggybacking on that, I'm finding, depending on the agency, that, you know, they have lots of things in PDF documents, which they think is electronic documents, right? And so even getting data into a format that you can give back to them in an Excel spreadsheet, where they can have someone that's interested in running pivot tables and things, where they can kind of control it themselves, is really helpful, as annoying as it may be from our end to try and get it all entered in the way we want it entered. But they don't, you know, they don't have SPSS or STATA, or, you know, they might have R, or someone who knows how to use R. But, you know, thinking about too, even if it's just presenting them back with their own data. And I try to be really conscious of that, because it's their data to begin with, right? Like, it's not ever my data, it's their data. So we spent a lot of time, Kristen and I, in the last 2 weeks trying to figure out attendance for this program. And it was a lot messier than I ever expected it to be. And I now have the most complete records of attendance. Well, I need to make sure that they have the most complete records of attendance. It's their data. And I bugged, I don't know how many people over email and text to try and confirm that kids were ahead attended and all this other kind of stuff. And so it's not mine, it's theirs. And so being really conscious of making sure that, you know, any improvements that you make goes back to them.
I saw Krista kind of laugh at that. And this is what I was kind of interested in her perspective on, because I feel like most of us are, you know, we're asking for data side of things, or requesting from courts or police or agencies, like, hey, can I have this? And we're very greedy. Like, we hold our hands out quite a bit, or demand this, and why isn't it in a usable Excel format instead of a PDF file that you have to convert into something? My personal favorite is Microsoft Access. I still can't figure that out. But I don't, from that perspective, working with us, I guess, like, you know, what's the preference in terms of, I mean, do we ask for it all at once, or kind of build up, here's what I'm looking for, and, you know, how to hurdle over kind of those obstacles that I know that's usable data in an agency form, but not necessarily for running a statistical analysis. If that makes sense.
I would say 9 times out of 10, we don't even know what we have and what format it exists in. So I think that that's kind of a struggle. A lot of times, and Natalie and I really ran into this, especially with, you know, our project's a little unique because it's juvenile records, and it's not only juvenile court records, it's also detention records, and it's also juvenile health data. So there's so many different layers of confidentiality. So I would say, like, going into it, make sure that you're well educated on the law. It would have been a significantly easier thing for not only my agency, but also our Marion County Superior Court to say no, because it's the easier thing to do. But then when we confronted them with the record sharing statute that specifically says that the court can authorize the share of juvenile court records to a researcher for a valid research project. So what we did after that is trying to understand the manner in which the court kept their records. So the data that we were asking for and the fields that we were asking for was something that they could pull very, very easily in a format that Natalie could see. So I would say that, you know, probably the best meeting we had, and Natalie might disagree, but was the meeting we had with the judges when we said, okay, what are your capabilities? What can you do? Because we had to go to the Indiana Supreme Court with our request, and they had to authorize it. And so we wanted to make sure that we didn't have to go back, because I don't recommend that experience. It was necessary, it was important, and we got what we needed, but it's not something that I would like to do a second time. So making sure that we were well prepared for the easiest way possible for the court and for probation to give us their documents. And we had to alter a little bit of what the scope of the project was after that. But we were open to that, because then that's how we eventually got the information.
It's so great that you're talking about that too, Kristen. The other thing is thinking through, like, if you're doing a project, if you're grant funded, or you've got a timeline that you're trying to work through, we allotted 6 months for that, 6 to 9 months, I think, for that. And I actually put in a kind of the world's blown up clause into my grant proposal and said, if we can't get access, we weren't sure we went forward not knowing if we had permission, because they won't sign something that gives you permission until you go through to get permission. So it was like a chicken and egg sort of thing. And so I had put into the proposal that if we don't have access after 9 months, then I'm done and I'll give the rest of the money back. And that we're gonna spend up to 9 months trying to get access, all the different access we need. And then if that doesn't work, then we're done. And Joyce was okay with that. I don't know if Indiana was all that happy with that, but I mean, what is it going to do without any data? And so, yes, Kristen, having an ally like Kristen, where she'd be like, she was like, no, the Supreme Court says this, and here's the statute, and here's this person, and here's how. I think there's a lot of laws around criminal justice data is the point. It's not just the juvenile data that we were working with or the court data. I think there's a lot of different laws around that. And if you can use those to your advantage where people are hesitant to share, and you can be like, no, this, the Supreme Court supports the sharing of this for a valid research project or an evaluation project, which is what we're doing. So you're not going to get in any trouble. We'll get the necessary permissions. You'll just help. You can just help me through your knowledge to get access, to figure out the language to get access. Yeah.
Those were, I mean, and that really bridges back to what you said in terms of building relationships and establishing that relationship and goals and expectations, that everybody's kind of on the same page from the start, and that carries over into all of these steps that are really important. So the like good theme in terms of why that's really important.
I think the other thing I just throw out, because Natalie was talking about how you give them back something that's of utility to them. We've worked on projects where we've transform their data. We've done coding that we had the time to do it because operational agencies are dealing with the day-to-day demand. So we're working on a project with the Cook County Probation Department where we're studying probation violations, and it's all in narrative. So they gave us a data file with all narrative texts, and we've got a data scientist, a graduate student working on a project, and he worked with us, and we came up with what are the keywords and themes to search this text for. And he wrote in our program that basically takes that text and converts it to a series of dichotomous variables to indicate whether or not the technical violations were for drug use or whatever. We gave the probation department's research unit back that code and said, here, now you can, because they were doing it the way we started out doing it. You read it, you code it, and do it. And we're like, okay, we've got only 29,000 more cases to go through. So that's a way to think about it is, especially if they have a research unit, they just don't have the capacity to do some of the, you know, the chin scratching thinking about how do we do this more effectively, or they don't have the skills or support to do it. That's what I found to be most enjoyable about the relationship, is then you really do feel I'm giving them something back. I'm making their job easier, and they can now continue
that, right? Like they can do that themselves, which is what they want. Right. They really want to be able to do. Right. So putting yourself out of business a little bit, right? Like
right.
Allowing them to continue on if they found it, the information really useful. Yeah.
Right. So it builds capacity, you know, in addition to
that. Yeah.
I mean, that really leads right into kind of the final area I was going at in terms of these, what we are giving back to agencies and kind of, you know, prolonging the relationship. But, you know, how do you frame your, and Dina asked this really well earlier in terms of how we communicate things, especially when it's bad news, and I'm still loving the compliment sandwich and that idea is, I guess, and what the keynote will focus a little bit on is that we often have really good ideas or here's how you could reduce this or improvements, but you know, practicalities of implementation and reform might limit this in addition to maybe just resistance to don't tell me how to do my job. You don't do this day to day. If you're looking at this from just a data set, I know these people, you know, and how to work with clients or judges or officers and whatnot. So, I mean, you're kind of not fighting, because most people, you know, maybe want to do better, but you potentially meet resistance both on a practical level from resources, as well as whether or not people want to implement change. So what are some maybe tips or strategies to make that as smooth as possible, I guess?
Yeah, I'll start. I think part of it goes back to what I said earlier. You've got to understand their environment and their priorities and how they get their work done, right? So you have to understand whether or not what you're recommending is even feasible. If they're not doing a full battery of assessments to determine if someone was a victim of domestic battery at prison intake, and you say, you know, you should really be using these four instruments and triangulating them. And they look at you and say, do you realize what it's like when we're processing inmate. We can't even determine if they're a gang member or not. And that we need to know for a lot more immediate reasons than what you may be looking for. So I think part of it gets to that is you've got to understand their environment and their limits. And you just got to figure out how do you frame what your work is. If you feel that your work contributes to what they're trying to do, you got to frame it that, hey, we're both in it for the same thing. We want to see lower rates of recidivism. And if you did a better assessment, you might be able to do that. Maybe you don't do it at the reception center. Maybe you do it at a different point, or let me come in and we'll pilot it on 100 people and we can show you what better information you might get from it. Right. So it's a long process to get to the point where you feel as though your recommendations can actually translate into changes. Part of it's just persistence, right? That you got to stick it out long enough to where they say, you know, this person actually knows what they're talking about. And for better, for worse, that's my situation with the Illinois Department of Corrections, because everybody I started my career out with that worked there, they've all been retired for a long time. So I'm kind of like the last person left that remembers some stuff or remembers some policy discussions. And so it's almost like a war of attrition. I'm kind of the last one around that can remember why was this policy created or why didn't we ever change this?
And I also think I think there's something about being humble and acknowledging that you don't do the work, you don't do the hard work on the street, right? You're not the street level bureaucrat. You're not the person that's doing the day-to-day work, the line level work, whether that's policing or probation or corrections. And so I always am very, very clear to say, I'm the people that actually have to make this work are doing the hard work. Right? Like it is work for me and it's hard work and all that other kind of stuff, but the people that are on the front lines that are doing it. And so making sure that you're humble enough to acknowledge that, you know, I'm not going to change the crime rates in Indianapolis. That's not going to be me. It's going to be the people on the street doing the hard work or the people, you know, all throughout the system doing the work. And so if I can inform your work and I can explain to you, how maybe I can make your job a little easier, a little more efficient or whatever, but ultimately it's up to you. And so it's sort of presenting them with a choice too, right? Like that this is, it's not my way or the highway. It's here's some information, do with it what you will. And being humble enough to realize they may or may not take your advice, and it may take years and years of persistence and presence, as David said, to get them to trust that you actually might have something that might benefit them.
I would say to keep in mind that there's going to be a significant language barrier between researchers and practitioners. It took a really long time of me telling Natalie, I do not understand a single thing coming out of your mouth right now and I need help. And whereas she was the same way with me about juvenile court records and the terms that I was using. And so making sure that you're comfortable enough in that position to say, like, hold up, can we just, you know, speak very plainly to each other, ask questions freely without that idea of like, they're gonna think I'm so dumb or, you know, I'm gonna lose this this contract because they're not gonna be confident in my abilities. I think having that relationship enough where you can say, you know, what you've asked me to do, you have oversimplified this issue. I think Natalie and I had that issue where, you know, one of our judges was like, you know, I just want to know if this program's successful. And we were like, but, you know, what does successful mean? How are you defining successful? Do you mean because they didn't recidivate or because they successfully completed your program or, you know, whatever. So, you know, don't be afraid to kind of pipe up and tell us, you know, what you're asking for is unreasonable too, because we do ask for very unreasonable things.
You said that, not me, Kristen.
Yeah. The other way we have to look at our work is, you know, we all work hard. If we're doing research and in this space, it's a lot of work. I always point out that what happens though when we make a mistake, if we invert a table, if we don't run a t-test or instead of it, no one dies, no one goes to prison because we blew it, and we don't lose our job generally. we have to recognize that changes to policy and practice can result in all those things. And the people that are, as Natalie said, the street level bureaucrats, the frontline staff, we have to actually implement this. The resistance oftentimes isn't because they don't want to do better. It's if something goes wrong, I'm the one that ultimately suffers, or I've got to explain why I did something that resulted in this adverse outcome. The point about how do we communicate, I think, as you were talking, Kristen, I could just imagine Natalie talking to you about odds ratios and chi-square and, you know, hierarchical linear modeling, and you looking at her like she's got horns coming out of her head. I think the most enjoyable thing I've had about this type of work is how do you take an extremely sophisticated, rigorous research design and translate that into what makes sense. So it's how do you present a graph showing the impact where you just have two bars. This is who went into the program, here's who didn't, here's the difference in their recidivism rate. And behind it all is your HLM or your logistic models and all your controls. But that to me is the most enjoyable, is how do you translate it so that the judge says, yep, it looks like it works. Doesn't look like it works as much as I thought, but it looks like it works. And so that really is a skill that takes a lot of development and testing. You've got to do these kinds of presentations, and I'm sure Natalie's done it, where she says something and she gets a bunch of blank stares, and you're like, okay, they didn't get that. Or I've had plenty of presentations where I've said that race didn't seem to impact the sentencing decision. And boy, did I get, I got stares. I got people laughing at me and said, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. And so I learned, it's like, okay, I got to be clear that I'm not saying there's not racism in the system, there's not bias, but at this particular decision point where a sentence is being imposed, it doesn't appear that race plays a direct role. Criminal history plays a primary role, and granted there's issues with that. But so you really have to develop that skill over time by getting exposure to the reactions that you're going to get and having a legislator say, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. You're an idiot if you don't think the system's not fraught with racism. And that's not what I said. I said at this particular point, it's not that. But
I've gotten to see you actually do part of that reason, because you're like, it's here, but then you break it down further. And then there was, I think, at ICG a couple of years ago, and you're like, but in these cases or certain places, and you do a really good job of simplifying that to make it really clear. And it really resonated, you can see, with people being able to get that quick takeaway.
And that goes back to your buddy in the agency too, dry run it by somebody so you don't get the deer in headlights, what the hell is she talking about look, or you don't know what you're talking about. Kristen might have been able to say, well, when you say that, they're gonna think that you don't know what you're talking about, because racism does affect the system. You might get some free feedback that will help when you're doing some of these presentations for the important audiences, right? The stakeholders and the policymakers. Not that the agency folks aren't important either, but if you're doing a big presentation that's potentially impactful, getting feedback ahead of time helps too.
And it's great when you've got a buddy that can give you a heads up and say, you know, this person that's going to be there, boy, they're all about female offenders or male offenders, or they're all about people with this kind of characteristic. And when you can highlight that in your presentation, like we looked at the outcomes, generally these are the patterns we saw, but when we looked at it by gender or sex, we saw this difference. And you know, you'll see people's eyes light up because like, oh man, now they're talking, you know, what I'm interested in. And it's just a matter of getting some good intelligence from your buddy or the people, you know, or you have a good understanding of who your audience is, and that's being present. That's hearing the kinds of questions that particular judge frequently asks about how are we doing with this particular group. So
I'd really like to ask if anybody has any additional questions, and you guys have been great in terms of kind of sharing the stage, and I've learned a lot, but I know there's plenty of people here who are also working with agencies. If there's additional experiences or you know, to make it open up, don't be shy. I know you spent a lot of time on Zoom today, everyone, but opportunity here.
Now the operatives of Zoom.
I know. And I gave you guys all permission to talk, and now nobody wants to. And I really miss not being able to see their video. Like the students who are like looking away, like don't make eye contact with me because I could call on you. But I won't do that. I'm sorry because it also limits the chat function. And we're getting plenty of thanks from people. And I agree, it was really informative. As somebody who's newer and kind of foraying into agency work and dealing with this, I'm not going to lie, a little selfish of me to do this panel, particularly because some of these that were based on experience. We were promised recidivism data for an outcome evaluation, and there was no recidivism. Like, just didn't exist, no way to connect it. So it's interesting when, you know, everybody thinks it's there and then it's not, or people who are resistant to you coming in and telling people how to do their job, which is not the intent, but I understand perceptions. So I'm equally defensive on that. Last chance, any questions? So I'll have them as soon as you hang up. All right, well, I'm gonna thank you so much to each of our panelists. This was incredibly informative for myself, and I share everybody else. So your time is very appreciated. We'll reconvene in about half an hour for the keynote if you have time to come back. Beth Huebner will kind of be bridging all of these things together in terms of policy and implementation and affecting change in the jail system as well. So she's a great presenter if you have time to come back. If not, that's great. Have a wonderful evening, and thank you all so much.
Thanks, Brianne. Thanks,
Alex. Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen, so much. It was lovely to meet you.
It was nice to meet you, too. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Dave. Now you can get out of your car and go into the house.
Right? I know.
I feel now like I trapped you in your car.
You don't know what I heard today. I totally had the time screwed up. We were on Eastern time, and we thought it was, I woke up this morning and was like, oh crap, it's on Central. So I'm texting her. I'm like, it's at 2:30.